Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I've given this talk the title An Historical Overview of the Growth of Marriage as an Avenue of Holiness, but I probably should have titled it something like The Growth of Marriage as an Avenue of Holiness Amidst All the Sort of Challenges and Societal Changes of the 20th Century. You can't really understand the theology of the body without understanding the context in which it came about. And so I want to lay that groundwork this evening. As by way of introduction, I would simply say, starting in the late 19th century and going really full throttle in the 20th century, Catholics and Christians in general began to be more cognizant of what the Second Vatican Council would eventually call the universal call to holiness. Namely, that every person, and not just priests or religious men or religious women, were called to close personal relationships with God, with Jesus Christ, and in fact, to grow in holiness. Now, it's not like that wasn't known before. But in the long history of the church, there are things that are known and that are teaching, and then there are things that are popularly known and popularly taught, or not popularly taught, we might say, right? As the milieus and as mores come and go. So, I mean, in fact, the lay faithful long had devotions and strove to walk the narrow way to be close to God. It's not like only monks and priests and nuns were moral. In fact, in some time periods of the church, many of the lay faithful were much more moral and much more holy than some of the clerics. Okay. But even devotions like the rosary, for instance, which is wonderful. I mean, it's the Dominican contribution, wonderful and beautiful, initially began to imitate the practices of monks, praying 150 Hail Marys, praying 150 Psalms, right? So as an attempt to imitate what religious did. But coming to the late 19th century and early 20th centuries, devotions, and this had been a process that was going on really since the 16th century, devotions began to proliferate that took life in the world on its own terms, instead of trying to make the lay faithful like some sort of lay monks or lay clerics, right? There were support systems for this. The establishment of guilds, you know, in the early 20th century, there were such things as the Guild for Catholic Lawyers, the Guild for Medical Doctors. So helping lay people to grow closer and be more, not only a witness, but grow closer to Christ in their work and their vocations as lay people in their jobs. Okay. The establishment of Catholic study groups. By the time you get into the early 20th century, lay Catholics are beginning to read scripture more and more on their own. There's an increasing desire for vernacular translations and beginning to read scripture in groups. I mean, today this is all very commonplace, but you understand that in the early 20th century, this was really developing and growing. Okay. I think especially here of the influence from the late 19th century of St. Thérèse of Lisieux's Little Way, which is really kind of a precursor to this understanding of the universal call to salvation. Now, in this context, marriage began to be seen not simply as the natural course of most people's lives geared toward procreation and education of children, which it is, but as, in fact, a deeply romantic relationship in which the spouses are there to assist and help one another, to love one another, and dare I say, to help each other grow in holiness. Once again, that just happened before, but there's what was going on and whether there was real self-reflection on the matter, right? Now, at the same time this is going on, there are also societal trends and as well as medical developments, scientific developments that would raise challenges to the Christian understanding of marriage. That in the early 20th century, moral theologians in the Catholic Church were not well equipped even if they were well-equipped to give an answer or to respond to the challenges, were not necessarily well-equipped to be convincing on the matter. So in this talk, I want to offer a little history of all of this, culminating in Pope St. Paul VI's landmark encyclical Humanae Vitae, which Pope St. John Paul II would develop the theology of the body to defend. Fundamentally, the theology of the body is about articulating the rationale of a central teaching of Humanae Vitae about marriage. Now, in the early 20th century, late 19th century and early 20th century, increasingly on the world stage, we see concerns about population. The birth rate per 1,000 persons had been steadily falling in the world since 1771, when it had been 38.6 in France, to 1860, when it was just 26.3. The birth control movement had gone international, and within the next 50 years, as early as 1900, with the first International Birth Control Congress in Liege. By 1935, these are just some interesting facts for you. By 1935, and this is an important point here, there were some 200, and this is the important, mechanical contraceptive devices employed in most Western societies. I've seen some diagrams of these, not fun. 200 mechanical devices. And there was a vast array of various attempts at chemical solutions. Standard medical practice began to approve the use of contraception as early as 1905 in France. It was not really a medical thing. And in 1922 in England. That trend was coupled by a real concern about overpopulation. The overpopulation movement took its cue from an early 19th century, now discredited theorist, Thomas Malthus. You probably have heard of Malthus and the Malthus proposal, who argued that population was increasing faster than the world's resources for human subsistence, particularly agricultural resources, and therefore competition for basic subsistence would lead to wars and violence in society. Now, of course, that proposal has been thoroughly debunked, you know, since. One of the most, my footnotes in this, but one of the most recent ones was actually in Nature and Science in 2002. There was actually an international congress in 1925 that was on birth control in New York City. And the theme of that international congress was overpopulation produces war. These trends certainly had a direct influence on Christians. The Anglican Communion experienced a rapid shift in its teaching. In 1908, and again in 1920, the Lambeth Conference condemned all contraception. So as late as 1920. But in 1930, so just 10 years later, with all of this going on, with a vote of 193-67, the Anglican bishops issued a resolution that there could be a clearly felt moral obligation to limit or to avoid parenthood. And therefore, there could be morally sound reasons to avoid as well, to avoid complete abstinence, to avoid parenthood, and to use other methods, although they didn't specify other methods. They did say that any use of these other methods could not come from any selfishness or convenience or simply a desire to live luxuriously. Historian John Noonan wrote a book on contraception in 1986. If this is a topic that you find fascinating, Noonan's book is sort of the Bible of the history of contraception in Christianity. Okay. He came to the conclusion, this is the conclusion he came to, quote, the teachers of the church have taught without hesitation or variation that certain acts preventing procreation are gravely sinful. No Catholic theologian has ever taught that contraception is a good act. The teaching on contraception is clear, and it's apparently fixed forever. That's Noonan's conclusion. This is remarkable because years later, Noonan, even though without disavowing any of the conclusions of his historical study, would argue that regardless of the fact that it is never taught otherwise, the church can, in fact, change its teaching on contraception. So that's his position. Now, the Catholic response to the Lambeth Conference of 1930, the shift in the Anglican Communion, it was a swift response. Less than 5 months later, and if you know anything about how the church operates, the fact that the Pope Pius XI issued a landmark encyclical less than 5 months after the Lambeth Conference, Casti Connubii. How many of you have anybody heard of this? So Pius XI's landmark encyclical from 1930, Casti Connubii is on Christian marriage. In his encyclical, Pius XI implicitly, he doesn't call them out by name, but he implicitly refers to the Anglican bishops when he writes, and here's a quote, "Openly departing from the uninterrupted Christian tradition, some recently have judged it possible solemnly to declare another doctrine regarding this question of contraception." The 1930 Lambeth Conference is the first time in history of any Christian church, any Christian community, of acceptance of contraception in the history of Christianity. Pius XI went on to write, and this is another direct quote, "No reason, however grave, may be put forward by which anything intrinsically against nature may become conformable to nature and morally good. Since, therefore, the conjugal act is destined primarily by nature for the begetting of children, those who, in exercising it, deliberately frustrate its natural power and purpose, sin against nature, and commit a deed which is shameful and intrinsically vicious." I mean, vicious is a strong word. I mean, it means vice, right? So Casti Connubii defends the intrinsic integrity of the conjugal act and procreation as a natural connection. He says this, this is another quote, "The Catholic Church, to whom God has entrusted the defense of the integrity and purity of morals, standing erect in the midst of the moral ruin which surrounds her," that's strong language, "in order that she may preserve the chastity of the nuptial union from being defiled by this foul stain, raises her voice in token of her divine ambassadorship, and through our mouth proclaims anew, any use whatsoever of matrimony exercised in such a way that the act is deliberately frustrated in its natural power to generate life is an offense against the law of God and of nature. And those who indulge in such are branded with the guilt of a grave sin." Popes usually don't talk like that anymore, but there you go. The 1970 Code of Canon Law, which is really the first codified canon law of the church. Before then, it was a lot of like loose decisions. It'd be like looking through Supreme Court decisions to find things. But the Code of Canon Law, 1917, first one, this is what it declared. And this kind of, remember, if you've heard this language before, this is where it comes from. "The primary end of marriage is the procreation and education of children." When you hear that, I want you to understand that those are not two different things. That's one thing. For the code, right? It's not procreation, and that it's not, it doesn't say the primary ends of marriage, the primary end. So it's not simply about having children. It's about the procreation and education of children. That's the primary end. The secondary ends are mutual support of the spouses and a remedy for concupiscence. Unlike the code, Pope Pius XI includes a sort of third object among the secondary ends. So mutual support and a remedy for concupiscence. The code mentions nothing of mutual love of the spouses. Pius XI, however, includes that as a third object among the secondary ends. So mutual support, remedy for concupiscence, and Pius XI says also cultivating mutual love between the spouses. He says the love between husband and wife, quote, pervades all duties of married life and holds pride of place in Christian marriage. It's the first time this is kind of being talked about in this way, so explicitly. And that the, and this is a direct quote, and that the mutual holding of husband and wife, this determined effort to perfect each other, can, in a very real sense, be said to be the chief reason and purpose of matrimony, provided matrimony be looked at not in the restricted sense as instituted for the proper conception and education of the child, but more widely as the blending of life as a whole and the mutual interchange and sharing thereof. So already you see a groping towards not just what nature demands, but that there is something more than just what nature demands. The cultivation of love, the perfecting of each other. Even if he can see he's kind of groping for the language to articulate this. This is why Pope Pius XI in Casti Connubii, something that was never explicitly said before, explicitly allows couples, and specifically says so, that certainly couples are free to engage in the conjugal act when they know for a fact that the wife is not fertile. There are other goods to be gained, he says, the mutual aid, the cultivation of mutual love, and the quieting of concupiscence. He says that the couple are permitted to seek so long as they are subordinated to the primary end of procreation, and as so long as the intrinsic nature of the act is preserved. Right. So keep that in mind as you go through like today and we talk a little bit tomorrow morning. The intrinsic nature of the act has to be preserved. But that is preserved even if you're engaged in the conjugal act during infertile periods. Okay. Pius XI's attempt to articulate the importance of the spouse's life of love, even if he has relegated that term, was relegated to use the terminology of primary and secondary ends, was really just a beginning of a shift to an emphasis on what we might call a sort of personalist view of marriage, right? The shift to a personalist understanding of marriage as opposed to focusing primarily on the natural processes or natural law began some years before the promulgation of Casti Connubii. One of the most notable lay scholars on marriage in the 20th century was Dietrich von Hildebrand, a professor of philosophy at the University of Munich. His wife, Alice von Hildebrand, some people might have read some of her stuff. She only passed away in the last decade or so. You know, she was much younger than him. Von Hildebrand's theology of marriage is certainly beyond the scope of this talk, but it should be noted that von Hildebrand stood diametrically opposed to what he considered an overly physicalist understanding that he thought dominated most of Catholic moral theology on marriage of his day. He lamented, and this is a quote, he lamented that our epoch is characterized by a terrible anti-personalism, a progressive blindness toward the nature and dignity of the spiritual person. Human life is considered exclusively from a biological point of view, and biological principles are the measure by which all human activities are judged. Now, I want to be clear. While that is likely the case for how things were being presented by his contemporaries, I don't think that was the intention. That's certainly not Aquinas's intention. Okay, and you can read my book and learn more about that. I'm not trying to sell the book. I'm just saying, you know. Yeah, we will have a table out later. I'm just kidding. But it is certainly true. It was certainly presented that way by a lot of what we would call today orthodox, conservative, or, you know, typical Catholic moral theologians. It probably did sound a little physicalist or overly biological, right? And I'll talk a little bit more about that. In 1928, von Hildebrand wrote that the marital act is, quote, not only a function, the generation of children, it also possesses a significance for man as a human being. Namely, it is the expression and fulfillment of wedded love and community life. And moreover, it participates after a certain fashion in the sacramental meaning of matrimony. Noonan notes that for the first time, a Catholic Noonan, this is a historian from earlier, notes that for the first time, a Catholic writer taught that love was a requirement of lawful marital conjugal acts. And he tied this novel demand to the ancient term fides, or fidelity. Fidelity required that person meet person in a giving of self. Now, how that shakes out in reality, you know, I think when you're married, does that mean every single conjugal act has to be some sort of, you know, mystical encounter and event between persons? No. All right. I mean, sometime tomorrow, maybe during, or Sunday during the Quad Liberal, you can ask me about this, but some of the theology of the body stuff went really too far in this direction, you know, not long, like in the 90s and early 2000s, you know. Yeah, I've got stories. For von Hildebrand, the conjugal act, the sex act, has not only an objective end, the procreation of children, but also an intrinsic significance for the couple. He says that the act of wedded communion has indeed the object of procreation, but in addition, the significance of a unique kind of union of love. And so von Hildebrand was perhaps one of the first, certainly the most popular, to distinguish between the end of marriage, the goals of marriage, and say the meaning of marriage, like a subjective meaning of it. In his book on marriage, he wrote that love is the primary meaning of marriage, just as birth is its primary end. He argued that conjugal love is not simply advancement on the love of friendship that now included sensuality, but rather he suggested that conjugal love is a unique self-gift of one person to another, which he called the I-thou communion, two people coming into deep communion with each other that moves beyond friendship. Marriage establishes the community in which this communion is fully actualized, while the conjugal act expresses the meaning of that communion. So von Hildebrand was a sort of new breed of Catholic scholars who, in the words of John Grabowski, a moral theologian across the street, strove to sort of balance the primary primacy of procreation as the end of marriage by delineating a sort of new category, meaning, in which love could become primary. Each value was seen to have a certain primacy in its own sphere, meaning and end. Hence, the natural value of procreation was balanced by a sort of new focus on personal self-giving love. The interaction between the meaning of personal self-giving love and the natural ends of marriage, this interaction, I would say, would occupy the thought of many Catholic moral theologians in the 20th century who were concerned about this question of marriage and contraception. On both sides of the spectrum. Now, this development was not limited as an enterprise restricted to professional theologians and clerics and philosophers. As I noted earlier, the laity were increasingly viewing marriage as a vocation, that their love expressed through conjugal intercourse could be a means to sanctity, and were increasingly realizing that marriage was better characterized as self-gift rather than merely a juridical contract or covenant even. And this sentiment was catalyzed by various lay movements that were beginning at the time. There was the Family Renewal Association that started in the early 1940s in New York City. And during those meetings, married couples, hundreds of married couples, would hear conferences on the vocation of marriage, on the love of spouses, and the meaning of sexuality in marriage. I mean, today, a lot of this is all very common. That initial association was followed up by the founding of the Cana Conference Movement, you know, seeing Cana as a sort of a model, and the Christian Family Movement. All of these movements tended to emphasize the personalist dimensions of marriage instead of juridical notions. There were others writing in this space. I'm not going to go through them all, but one example of someone who worked closely with von Hildebrand but departed from him is another theologian by the name of Herbert Doms, who, in depending on who you read, confused the whole thing and seemed to want to raise the union of spouses to being primary to the detriment of procreation and education. In 1944, the Roman Rota, which In those days, there were two real main offices in the church, the Vatican, that would answer serious theological questions. One was the Holy Office, if you've heard of that, which ran the Inquisition, eventually became the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, now the Dicastery for the Doctrine of Faith. The Roman Rota was the other one, which tended to focus more on canonical or legal questions in the church. So this kind, which shows you something, that these questions on marriage fell under Roman Rota and not under issues of faith, you know, in the 1940s Vatican, right? But they issued a decree, having read, and most people think it is in response to Herbert Doms, who was a Catholic. The Roman Rota issued a decree in 1944 on the nature of marriage, and they said that we can speak of the primary ends in two ways. One, and they use traditional Thomistic language on this, the finis operis, which is to mean, it's Latin, means the end of the work itself, what the work, what the action does. And he says, the good which the finis operis is the good which matrimony tends to, of its very nature, to obtain, and which God the Creator gave it. And that's, of course, the procreation and education of children. That's the objective work of marriage. But it distinguished the finis operis from the finis operantis, which is the end of the worker or the one doing the act. So your subjective intention, in other words. And the Roman Rota acknowledged that people choose to get married for all sorts of reasons, the finis operantis. But regardless of why you intend to get married, the finis operantis, the finis operis does not remain untouched. I mean, it remains untouched. It's still the end of marriage to have children and to educate them. All right. And then it said the secondary ends, of course, are the mutual help and the remedy for concupiscence. So it says that the finis operantis need not always coincide with the finis operis, even at every moment of the marriage and or even every time the conjugal act is engaged. The subjective end, my subjective intention, is different than the objective purpose. However, the Roman Rota said, any marriage in which the fina operantis, say, your intention to get married, is contrary to the finis operis, or any conjugal act in which the intention of one or both spouses is contrary to the natural end, is invalid. So even today, a couple cannot get married in the Catholic Church if they reveal that their intention is absolutely to be closed, never to have children. Right now, there's some footnotes to that, like for older couples or infertile couples. But if there's an absolute closure to life, it's not a valid marriage. Right. So, whatever they want to get married for, it's contrary to the finis operis. Another response in 1944 from the Roman Rota just reaffirmed all of this, you know. Pope Pius XII never wrote an encyclical on marriage, but, and this has been generally forgotten, he had a heck of a lot of audiences with newlywed couples. And we have all of those speeches. And some of them are pretty frank and very honest and very forthright. Sarto House, which I have to say is a publishing house of, I think, Society of St. Pius X, published a whole volume. It's about 350, 400 pages of like single space text. That's how many meetings he had with newlyweds over the course of his pontificate, right? It was kind of like a theology of the body of the 1950s. Now, moving on then to what I would call the first phase of all of this. A man named Benjamin Sieve developed the pill changes everything. The pill kind of is what puts a monkey wrench in this whole conversation, right? Benjamin Sieve developed the first commercially available oral contraception in 1952. He was a Catholic, no, an Anglican, I think. I'm never going to pronounce this correctly. You would think after all these years given this talk, I would learn. I would just go look it up. But phosphorylated hesperidin is what it was, which is actually a natural enzyme that occurs in citrus fruits. This is 1952. So after doing several studies, he noted that a significant portion of the couples who used this experienced a suspension of fertility if both men and women took the pill. And he hypothesized that it worked by making the ovum stronger and the sperm weaker, so that fertilization could not happen. However, this pill, although it was commercially available, was never, in fact, widely used. And, you know, as I was looking some of this up today, because I was looking up him, you know, because when I did this research, I really didn't, because he's like a footnote. He had this first pill that really just didn't work that well. And I read today, and I didn't know this, that he committed suicide less than a year after inventing the pill, because he left a note that was never publicly revealed, but his wife was she found him hanging in their bedroom. She said publicly that it was because he felt ridiculed because his pill was not really accepted popularly, you know. So you might say a prayer for Benjamin Sieve, you know, thank God, maybe in those last moments that God had mercy on him. There was really no evidence that it worked reliably as he thought it did. So its fate on the commercial market was sealed by the more successful and more widely promoted progesterone pill, which was developed in 1953 and legalized in the United States in 1960. Because its primary mechanism was the hormone progesterone, the introduction of this contraceptive pill would prove to be the overwhelming catalyst pushing the birth control debate in the Catholic Church for the remainder of the century. The first stage of the debate revolved primarily around legitimate uses for the pill in virtue of the principle of double effect. You all know the principle of double effect, just generally, right? So, if you've got an action, a choice that is good or morally neutral, but has two effects. One effect is morally good. One effect is morally evil or immoral. As long as the morally evil effect is not caused by the good effect, but actually flows from the action, and there's a sort of a relative need, and you can. If you're intending the good effect, you can tolerate the evil effect, right? So is there a therapeutic use for the pill, which is there something good that it does, even if you tolerate that it's suppressing fertility, right? The other principle that was in play in this is the principle of totality. So you guys know the principle of totality. It's a bioethical principle that the whole is to be preserved and the parts of the whole are to be preserved unless a part is becoming vicious or detrimental to the whole. So it is not moral to amputate your arm. And there is a medical condition. I always forget the name of it, but there is a medical condition. Some people who really do think they're supposed to be walking around with only one arm. It's in the DSM still. It's not moral to amputate body parts unless the body part becomes detrimental to your physical health, like, you know, diabetics, gangrenes, some sort of staph infection, you know. So that's the principle of totality. So you can see how this can play, that can play an effect too. Like, is there something about a woman's fertility or health that would require amputating that for her health? Okay. This would be in today's, you all heard today, Princess Catherine is suffering cancer, you know, my hunch is that it's probably a uterine cancer, or a uterine tumor or something that was removed, because just based on what she said, which is sad and tragic, you know, if that's the case, because it obviously also means no more children for them. But that would be a classic example of the principle of totality at work. You would not remove a uterus unless it's become like physically problematic and it's going to cost the life of the mother. That raises all sorts of fun things, which we do here in one of our classes, on what to do about things like ectopic pregnancies or pregnancies. I mean, that raises all sorts of moral questions that good Catholic moral principles can help resolve, even if the resolution is challenging and difficult, they can be resolved, right? Okay, that was a little digression. Here we go. So the primary concern of this first period of the debate was determining the appropriate use, and this is the one you think about these things, and just what I was just saying, the appropriate use of biology and medicine at the service of the person. Some moral theologians were simply more permissive on this than others, though all agreed in this early stage that direct sterilization was wrong because of its intentional circumvention of the natural finality of the process. So direct sterilization is always wrong. Everyone agreed at that at this early stage. So they were concerned, therefore, with isolating whether there were legitimate reasons in which the good of the person, the good of the woman, might justify the temporary sterilization caused by the pill. Right? It's temporary infertility. Now, one of the real heroes in this early part of the debate was, believe it or not, an American Jesuit. No laughs on that. Father John Lynch. Okay. He was opposed already to contraception. He had written a lot about it. But he already had accepted the possibility that there could be therapeutic uses for the pill. And he identifies several infertility disorders that might legitimize the use of the pill. Now, keep in mind, this is very early on. They have no idea what's going on. You know, I mean, it's, you know, we know vastly more about the female body and the female cycle than, you know, they necessarily did in the 1950s. You know, they knew more than probably most women on the street, but still, you know, we know vastly more about how even things like endometriosis, how all this stuff can affect a woman. All right. So there's not only that, but these are Catholic priests who are talking about this. So, okay. So he does think that there are certainly several infertility disorders that might be helpful. So he argued that these treatments could not be considered the suspension of fertility in any sense of the word, since they would be disorders in which the woman was already infertile or already experiencing some sort of temporary infertility. So, for example, you know, he thought maybe the correction of a menstrual cycle and other fertility disorders were not only licit, but could be morally used in a positive way. Now, there were two other possibilities that were being discussed at the time, but which there was no universal agreement. The first, and this was generally more accepted, was that of regulating the woman's ovulatory cycle. Its first explicit endorsement was by Louis Janssens, who was a Louvain theologian. He becomes a problem later, but I'm not going to go into it. Now, mentioning nothing of the contraceptive purpose of the pill, it's Janssens who focuses entirely on the possible therapeutic uses and identifies a principle by where the pill could perhaps correct pathologies in the natural mechanisms of a woman's body. So in that sense, he says it's just like any other medicine. All right. So the pill could legitimately be used. Now, he suggested another more controversial. One is like helping to regulate ovulatory cycles. You can kind of see how, okay, well, maybe if it does that, it's not clear that it does now. We know a little bit better about these things. But the other one, let's see if you can see the difference on this one. He suggested this other one, which even at the time was more controversial. He noted that women are generally infertile during the period of lactation following pregnancy. Not always, but generally there's a space of time where they cannot get pregnant. So he says, and he's correct on this, that this natural mechanism is sometimes lacking in women who then experience fertility while they're nursing their new infants. So he argues that the use of the progesterone pill during this period of lactation is therapeutic and morally licit in order to ensure that the new mother is in fact infertile during the months following the birth of her child. And that's, he identifies as simply correcting a defect in nature, that every woman should be able to experience this. And if every woman doesn't, we can give them the pill so that they do. Pius XII accepts the reasoning of double effect in some situations and even the principle of totality as long as infertility is never the intention. So that's the key. All right. So when Pius XII speaks about this sort of thing, for example, in these addresses to the newlyweds, he warns that it is necessary to reject the view of a number of doctors and moralists who permit these practices, contracept the pill, basically, when medical indications make conception undesirable, right? When you're nursing a newborn infant. In these cases, the use of medication has as its end the prevention of conception by preventing ovulation. These are instances, therefore, of direct sterilization, he says. So he says it's necessary to evaluate all the principles of morality when trying to evaluate whether or not this is really a medicine correcting a pathology. I mean, I'm translating that into our modern lingo, right? Now, you can perhaps see the trouble here. Until the invention of the pill, contraception was always some physical thing, a diaphragm, a barrier of some sort, okay? And so it was easy to argue that a barrier in the conjugal act was in fact inserting a wall between the communion of men and women. You can see that why that's different. It's and somewhat of an easier argument to make. It becomes a whole different level when we're not talking about a physical barrier anymore. We're talking about medicine, or what people would say is medicine. It changes the whole nature of the argument and the conversation. All right. You have something that seems like medicine and actually seems to be working with the biology of the woman. Now, today we know that there are all sorts of side effects and everything else, but if you assume it's biology, assumes it's medicine, it's working with her biology, why not, right? And at the same time, an increasing focus away from a morality built on physical actions in nature to focusing on persons, to a philosophy, and I'm not going to get into this, and maybe Professor Hochschild will, phenomenology is coming to bear at this time of a philosophy that focuses on human experience as opposed to human nature. Moral theologians were okay with using the pill to increase fertility generally, but not to regulate the menstrual cycle because it could be in fact harming the menstrual cycle and causing a lack of ovulation. And there were ongoing debates, as I say, on the suspension of fertility during lactation. Everything sort of takes a shift in 1963. A Catholic medical doctor from Baltimore, John Rock was his name, published a book called The Time Has Come. And he explicitly rejected all moral analyses of the natural ends of the conjugal act and any biophysical analysis in favor of what he said were the needs of the woman and the needs of the couple. And he said the pill was a medical way, because already you have Pius XI, who's allowed, who was explicitly said, couples can engage in the conjugal act even when they know the woman is infertile. So this is the method that doesn't work, and it is different than NFP, the calendar method or the rhythm method, right? So John Rock simply says that there is no moral difference between the pill and the calendar method or the use and resorting only to the so-called safe period. He said there's a natural safe period and then there's the pill-induced safe period. Either way, it's the same thing. All right, now I'll let you figure out whether or not those are morally the same thing. They're not. Okay. Pius XI and Pius XII, again, supported the possibility of the use of periodic continence. Rock said the pill is medicine, and it uses reason. Once again, our Jesuit hero, so you can quote me, I did refer to a Jesuit as a hero. Once again, our Jesuit hero, Father John Lynch, comes to the fore to bring his response. He argued that imitating natural occurrences like the natural safe period is not always within our rights, as in the case, and his example was, the natural circumstances surrounding death. Quote, it's quite obvious that death from natural causes is a very common occurrence, but that biological fact doesn't justify one's anticipating nature in this respect by deliberately or directly terminating innocent human life. Which is an interesting thing given today's world, and we're starting to talk more and more about euthanasia and assisted suicide. But if Rock's ideas were initially rejected in the United States, they would receive a more fair reception in Europe. Louis Janssens argues that the pill doesn't violate the integrity of the conjugal act. It introduces no barrier. 3 months before the Second Vatican Council's first session, Pope St. John the 23rd established a commission to discern the question of contraception in church teaching. I'm not going to go into all of those details. He died 3 months after initiating that that commission and not long after the first session of the Second Vatican Council. Pope St. Paul VI decided that the commission should continue its work. It would meet just four times between 1963 and 1966, and each time it was kind of a different committee. Like, there was a smaller group, and then I think Paul VI added some lay people, and then in the third meeting, he introduced some more bishops and priests. And then the fourth meeting, I mean, it got really huge. Like, there were there was like the executive level, and then every other level. Karol Wojtyła, the man who became John Paul II, was invited to be part of this. He, in the fourth meeting, he couldn't make it because the communists in Poland wouldn't let him out of the country. He was on a travel restriction. The council did not address contraception directly. There were some politics at the council about this. It is spoken of implicitly in Gaudium et Spes. Paul VI wanted some language inserted about this. The council fathers were ambivalent about it, but Gaudium Spes does refer to children as the preeminent gift of marriage, and it does cite casti connubii, but it doesn't mention primary or secondary ends. In fact, from this period forward, I know of only one document, which was a minor document, that ever uses that language again. It's like that language you won't find even in the catechism, primary and secondary ends. It's not used again. The work of the commission came to an end on June 25th, 1966, and the reports were delivered to Pope Paul VI 3 days later. So July 28th, 1966, he gets this three reports. He gets the majority report, the minority report, and the minority's rebuttal of the majority report. All right. The majority was in favor of changing church teaching. The majority of the committee was in favor of church. How many of you, you can see a surprise on your face. Yeah, that's a surprise for a lot of people. The majority were in favor of changing church teaching. The minority, basically, their argument was the teaching can't be changed because this was the constant teaching of the church. And when they rebutted the majority report, because they themselves were swimming in the same water. So they didn't want to rely entirely on natural law arguments because they also had conceded some of this personalist language about marriage and the dignity of the person and love, which is all true and good. But because they conceded that, they admitted they didn't have a good argument for why the teaching shouldn't change, other than it was always the teaching. I mean, there's a line where they said, if we could produce a good argument, there would be no need for this commission, if it were obvious, right? Paul VI takes those documents and sits on them for 2 years. 2 years, like not a word. And then in July. Oh, I should also tell you, the documents were also, I mean, the more things change, the more they stay the same. The documents were also leaked to Catholic media. They weren't supposed to be. And the media source in America, I'm going to be so happy if I tell you this name and none of you know who it is. The National Catholic Reporter. Does anyone know who the National Catholic Reporter is? All right. So they've been around a long time and have been pushing the envelope since the beginning. So they were the ones that published in the United States the leaked confidential reports that were written for Paul VI. All right. So July 1968. He signs Humanae Vitae. He issues it 4 days later. The opening paragraphs, in fact, are verbatim from the majority report. Verbatim. So when you read the first 9 paragraphs of Humanae Vitae, that's exactly what the majority told him. Verbatim. All right. Marriage is about the mutual gift of self. All good stuff. We must cooperate with God in the generation and rearing of new lives. Married love is a fully human love and not merely a question of natural instinct. Married love should be fecund and give life. And there was a conversation, there's material in those first 9 paragraphs on responsible parenthood. That's all the majority language. But then paragraph 10 makes a definitive shift, right? He says this, And this is where you can imagine the majority as they're reading this, because they have no idea what it's going to say. They're like, my God, this is our, we wrote this. Wow, he's going down our, he's going down our, he's following, it's going to, he's going to take our side of this. And then they get to paragraph 10, and here's what it says. From this, it follows that the married couple are not free to act as they choose in serving in the service of transmitting life, as if it were wholly up to them to decide what is the right course to follow. On the contrary, they are bound to ensure that what they do corresponds to the will of God, the Creator. The very nature of marriage and its use makes His will clear, which the constant teaching of the church spells out. Right. Article 11 summarizes the natural law arguments that the minority provided. Article 12, and this is the one that gives everyone that's oceans of ink have been spilled on. So I'm going to quote you the whole thing, all right? This particular doctrine, often expounded by the magisterium of the church, is based, and this is the thing to hold on to for tomorrow, is based on the inseparable connection established by God, which man on his own initiative may not break. What is the inseparable connection between? Here it is. Between the unitive significance or meaning and the procreative significance or meaning, which are both, he says, inherent to the marriage act. There's the unitive and the procreative, and they're inseparable. He says, he goes on to say, the reason is that the fundamental nature of the marriage act, while uniting husband and wife in the closest intimacy, also renders them capable of generating new life. And this is a result of laws written into the actual nature of man and woman. And if each of these essential qualities, the unitive and the procreative, is preserved, the use of marriage fully retains its sense of true mutual love and its ordination to the supreme responsibility of parenthood to which man is called. We believe that our contemporaries are particularly, this might be a little optimistic, we believe that our contemporaries are particularly capable of seeing that this teaching is in harmony with human reason. Paul is a little optimistic there. He offers no arguments other than that. Why? That's the problem of Humanae Vitae, in a nutshell. They were all groping to hold on to the natural arguments, but yet society and many in the church had kind of moved towards this language on the dignity of the person, the dignity of marriage. And Paul VI, 2 years, this is what he came up with, and still couldn't really fully articulate the whole shebang. Okay. Now, when it came out, the reactions, and I'm coming to an end here. I've gone on long here. The bishops' conferences, less than half of the bishops' conferences in the world expressed clear and unmitigated agreement. Less than half. Right. Others emphasized the primacy of conscience and that this encyclical could not be considered infallible. These are bishops' conferences. Others gave statements that were rather confused and ambivalent, didn't know what to do about it. In America, across the street at CUA, my alma mater, a priest and moral theologian, Father Charles Curran, who is still alive, teaches at Southern Methodist University in Texas. Is that where that is? He must be retired by this point. Was using the school's fax machine on the day it was released to have the encyclical faxed to him and others a page at a time, long distance over a regular phone line in the 1960s. So they basically were getting a page at a time, being able to read this page while this other one was still printing out on a dot matrix fax machine, okay? And, you know, the thing is like 70 pages, you know, printed 80 pages. By 3 o'clock the next morning, they had obtained the signatures of 87 American theologians expressing dissent. Funny story. Does anyone know the name William May? Has anyone read it? Yes, Professor Hawkins. He was a great lay. He taught here at the John Paul II Institute, and the John Paul II Institute was sharing space with us. Great lay moral theologian, one of the best of the late 20th century. He actually signed it. The funny story is he signed it. He was always, because he would have lunch with the friars, like whenever he was teaching in our refectory. And he, so this old guy, you know, he's just a defender of Humanae Vitae, like the rest of his life, you know. But he signed it. He signed the dissent of Father Charles Curran. Then he went home and told his wife, who promptly smacked him and then made him get in the car and go back and take his name off the, take his name off the dissent. So, yeah. Yeah. She was like, do you sign this? It's about our life together. You don't even talk to me about it. Charlie Curran had a whole list of things that he thought were problematic about it, that it was ecclesiology was deficient, it had a weird view of natural law. He rejected the majority of the papal commission. He started calling it physicalist, that term, like, of natural law, that you're a physicalist, all you care about is biology. That became a pejorative. No one wants to be a physicalist or biologist, you know, on these things. The signatures grew to over 600 theologians and teachers within months, all published, by the way, by our great Catholic media friends, the National Catholic Reporter. All right. It was the first time there was real dissent, public dissent in recent memory, if ever, in which the priests involved were in fact not punished. They were not punished. The Bishop of Washington, Archbishop Boyle, I think it was Boyle at the time, you know, talked to Rome, and Boyle didn't want to punish him. So it's the first time you have priests and clerics dissenting from a teaching of the Pope publicly, who don't invent and who aren't like Martin Luther and become some sort of Protestant because they're get excommunicated. First time. Just no discipline whatsoever. They're allowed to go back to teaching. Eventually, Curran is fired from Seaway. His mission to teach in Catholic schools, Catholic, you know, he's not allowed to teach in a Catholic. That's the limit of the punishment he ever received as a priest. And he's still a priest in good standing. So still saying Mass, still preaching, and preaching these sorts of homilies. All right. Paul VI, just to say this, I know I've gone long, so I'm just going to conclude. Paul VI never published another encyclical in his pontificate, and he was pope for another 10 years. He was clearly traumatized by the whole experience. Clearly traumatized. One of the major defenders of Humanae Vitae would come to be Karol Wojtyła throughout the 1970s, and that's really what the theology of the body is trying to articulate. And that's what we'll focus on tomorrow. So I would just say, leave you with that. These are the three things that sort of came into play in the 20th century. You know, the deeper understanding of marriage, this personalism view, while at the same time increasing scientific and medical advancement, the progress of science, and finally, that this personalist view of marriage was affecting how moral theologians articulated the teaching, but also how married couples were starting to rediscover their own understanding of marriage. So that's where I'll leave it. I'm sorry, I went longer than I thought. We got a few minutes for questions. Yeah, I should have ended sooner. But
thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.